Chapter 32. Swimming in company with the girls of the valley, a canoe, effects of the taboo, a pleasure excursion on the pond, beautiful freak of Feiwei Manchua making, a stranger arrives in the valley, his mysterious conduct, native oratory, the interview, its results, departure of the stranger, returning health and peace of mind gave a new interest to everything around me. I sought to diversify my time by as many enjoyments as lay within my reach. Bathing in company with troops of girls formed one of my chief amusements. We sometimes enjoyed the recreation in the waters of a miniature lake, to which the central stream of the valley expanded. This lovely sheet of water was almost circular in figure, and about 300 yards across. Its beauty was indescribable. All around its banks waved luxuriant masses of tropical foliage, soaring high above which were seen, here and there, the symmetrical shaft of the coconut tree, surmounted by its tufts of graceful branches, drooping in the air like so many waving ostrich plumes. The ease and grace with which the maidens of the valley propelled themselves through the water, and their familiarity with the element, were truly astonishing. Sometimes they might be seen gliding along just under the surface, without apparently moving hand or foot, then throwing themselves on their sides, they darted through the water, revealing glimpses of their forms, as, in the course of their rapid progress, they shot for an instant partly into the air. At one moment they dived deep down into the water, and the next they rose bounding to the surface. I remember upon one occasion plunging in among a parcel of these river nymphs, and counting vainly on my superior strength, sought to drag some of them under the water, but I quickly repented my temerity. The amphibious young creatures swarmed about me like a shoal of dolphins, and seizing hold of my devoted limbs, tumbled me about, and ducked me under the surface, until from the strange noises which rang in my ears, and the supernatural visions dancing before my eyes, I thought I was in the land of the spirits. I stood indeed as little chance among them as a cumbrous whale attacked on all sides by a legion of swordfish. When at length they relinquished their hold of me, they swam away in every direction, laughing at my clumsy endeavors to reach them. There was no boat on the lake, but at my solicitation and for my special use, some of the young men attached to Marheyo's household, under the direction of the indefatigable Cory Cory, brought up a light and tastefully carved canoe from the sea. It was launched upon the sheet of water, and floated there as gracefully as a swan. But, melancholy to relate, it produced an effect I had not anticipated. The sweet nymphs, who had sported with me before on the lake, now all fled its vicinity. The prohibited craft, guarded by the edicts of the taboo, apostrophe extended the prohibition to the waters in which it lay. For a few days, Cory Cory, with one or two other youths, accompanied me in my excursions to the lake, and while I paddled about in my light canoe, would swim after me shouting and gambling in pursuit. But I as ever partial to what is termed in the young men's own book the society of virtuous and intelligent young ladies, apostrophe and in the absence of the mermaids, the amusement became dull and insipid. One morning I expressed to my faithful servitor my desire for the return of the nymphs. The honest fellow looked at me bewildered for a moment, and then shook his head solemnly, and murmured taboo, taboo. Apostrophe giving me to understand that, unless the canoe was removed I could not expect to have the young ladies back again. But to this procedure I was averse. I not only wanted the canoe to stay where it was, but I wanted the bodious Feiwei to get into it and paddle with me about the lake. This latter proposition completely horrified Cory Cory's notions of propriety. He inveighed against it, as something too monstrous to be thought of. It not only shocked their established notions of propriety, but was at variance with all their religious ordinances. However, although the taboo was a ticklish thing to meddle with, I determined to test its capabilities of resisting an attack. I consulted the chief Mahevi, who endeavored to dissuade me from my object, but I was not to be repulsed, and accordingly increased the warmth of my solicitations. At last he entered into a long, and I have no doubt a very learned and eloquent exposition of the history and nature of the taboo as affecting this particular case, employing a variety of most extraordinary words, which, from their amazing length and sonorousness, I have every reason to believe, were of a theological nature. But all that he said failed to convince me. Partly, perhaps, because I could not comprehend a word that he uttered, but chiefly, that for the life of me, I could not understand why a woman would not have as much right to enter a canoe as a man. At last he became a little more rational, and intimated that, out of the abundant love he bore me, he would consult with the priests, and see what could be done. How it was that the priesthood of Taipei satisfied the affair with their consciences, I know not, but so it was, and Feiwei dispensation from this portion of the taboo was at length procured. Such an event I believe never before had occurred in the valley, but it was high time the islanders should be taught a little gallantry, and I trust that the example I set them may produce beneficial effects. Ridiculous, indeed, that the lovely creatures should be obliged to paddle about in the water, like so many ducks, while a parcel of great strapping fellows skimmed over its surface in their canoes. The first day after Feiwei's emancipation, I had a delightful little party on the lake, the damsels Cory Cory, and myself. My zealous body servant brought from the house a calabash of poi poi, half a dozen young coconuts stripped of their husks, three pipes, as many yams, and me on his back a part of the way. Something of a load. But Cory Cory was a very strong man for his size, and by no means brittle in the spine. We had a very pleasant day. My trusty valet plied the paddle, and swept us gently along the margin of the water, beneath the shades of the overhanging thickets. Feiwei and I reclined in the stern of the canoe, on the very best terms possible with one another, the gentle nymph occasionally placing her pipe to her lip, and exhaling the mild fumes of the tobacco, to which her rosy breath added a fresh perfume. Strange as it may seem, there is nothing in which a young and beautiful female appears to more advantage than in the act of smoking. How captivating is a Peruvian lady, swinging in her gaily woven hammock of grass, extended between two orange trees, and inhaling the fragrance of a choice cigarro. But Feiwei, holding in her delicately formed olive hand the long yellow reed of her pipe, with its quaintly carved bowl, and every few moments languishingly giving forth light wreaths of vapor from her mouth and nostrils, looked still more engaging. We floated about thus for several hours, when I looked up to the warm, glowing, tropical sky, and then down into the transparent depths below. And when my eye, wandering from the bewitching scenery around, fell upon the grotesquely tattooed form of Cory Cory, and finally encountered the pensive gaze of Feiwei, I thought I had been transported to some fairy region, so unreal did everything appear. This lovely piece of water was the coolest spot in all the valley, and I now made it a place of continual resort during the hottest period of the day. One side of it lay near the termination of a long gradually expanding gorge, which mounted to the heights that environed the vale. The strong trade wind, met in its course by these elevations, circled and eddied about their summits, and was sometimes driven down the steep ravine and swept across the valley, ruffling in its passage the otherwise tranquil surface of the lake. One day, after we had been paddling about for some time, I disembarked Cory Cory, and paddled the canoe to the windward side of the lake. As I turned the canoe, Feiwei, who was with me, seemed all at once to be struck with some happy idea. With a wild exclamation of delight, she disengaged from her person the ample robe of tapa which was knotted over her shoulder for the purpose of shielding her from the sun, and spreading it out like a sail, stood erect with upraised arms, in the head of the canoe. We American sailors pride ourselves upon our straight, clean spars, but a prettier little mast than Fayaway made was never shipped aboard of any craft. In a moment the tapper was distended by the breeze, the long brown tresses of Fayaway streamed in the air, and the canoe glided rapidly through the water, and shot towards the shore. Seated in the stern, I directed its course with my paddle until it dashed up the soft sloping bank, and Fayaway, with a light spring, alighted on the ground, whilst Cory, who had watched our maneuvers with admiration, now clapped his hands in transport, and shouted like a madman. Many a time afterwards was this feat repeated. If the reader has not observed ere this, that I was the declared admirer of Miss Fayaway, all I can say is that he is little conversant with affairs of the heart, and I certainly shall not trouble myself to enlighten him any farther. Out of the calico I had brought from the ship I made a dress for this lovely girl. In it she looked, I must confess, something like an opera dancer. The drapery of the latter damsel generally commences a little above the elbows, but my island beauties began at the waist, and terminated sufficiently far above the ground, to reveal the most bewitching ankle in the universe. The day that Fayaway first wore this robe was rendered memorable by a new acquaintance, being introduced to me. In the afternoon I was lying in the house, when I heard a great uproar outside, but being by this time pretty well accustomed to the wild halloos which were almost continually ringing through the valley, I paid little attention to it, until old Marheyo, under the influence of some strange excitement, rushed into my presence, and communicated the astounding tidings, Marnupimi. Which being interpreted, implied that an individual by the name of Marnu was approaching. My worthy old friend evidently expected that this intelligence would produce a great effect upon me, and for a time he stood earnestly regarding me, as if curious to see how I should conduct myself, but as I remained perfectly unmoved, the old gentleman darted out of the house again, in as great a hurry as he had entered it. Marnu, cogitated I have never heard that name before. Some distinguished character, I presume, from the prodigious riot the natives are making, the tumultuous noise drawing nearer and nearer every moment, while Marnu, was shouted by every tongue. I made up my mind that some savage warrior of consequence, who had not yet enjoyed the honor of an audience, was desirous of paying his respects on the present occasion. So vain had I become by the lavish attention to which I had been accustomed, that I felt half inclined, as a punishment for such neglect, to give this Marnu a cold reception, when the excited throng came within view, convoying one of the most striking specimens of humanity that I ever beheld. The stranger could not have been more than 25 years of age, and was a little above the ordinary height. Had he a single hair's breadth taller, the matchless symmetry of his form would have been destroyed. His unclad limbs were beautifully formed, whilst the elegant outline of his figure, together with his beardless cheeks, might have entitled him to the distinction of standing for the statue of the Polynesian Apollo, and indeed the oval of his countenance, and the regularity of every feature reminded one of an antique bust. But the marble repose of art was supplied by a warmth and liveliness of expression, only to be seen in the South Sea Islander under the most favorable developments of nature. The hair of Marnu was a rich curling brown, and twined about his temples and neck in little close curling ringlets, which danced up and down continually when he was animated in conversation. His cheek was of a feminine softness, and his face was free from the least blemish of tattooing, although the rest of his body was drawn all over with fanciful figures, which unlike the unconnected sketching usual among these natives appeared to have been executed in conformity with some general design. The tattooing on his back in particular attracted my attention. The artist employed must indeed have excelled in his profession. traced along the course of the spine, was accurately delineated the slender, tapering and diamond-checkered shaft of the beautiful Ardu tree, branching from the stem on each side, and disposed alternately, were the graceful branches drooping with leaves all correctly drawn and elaborately finished. Indeed, the best specimen of the fine arts I had yet seen in Taipei. A rear view of the stranger might have suggested the idea of a spreading vine tacked against a garden wall. Upon his breast, arms and legs were exhibited an infinite variety of figures, every one of which, however, appeared to have reference to the general effect sought to be produced. The tattooing I have described was of the brightest blue, and when contrasted with the light olive color of the skin, produced an unique and even elegant effect. A slight girdle of white tappa, scarcely 2 inches in width, but hanging before and behind in spreading tassels, composed the entire costume of the stranger. He advanced surrounded by the islanders, carrying under one arm a small roll of native cloth, and grasping in his other hand a long and richly decorated spear. His manner was that of a traveler conscious that he is approaching a comfortable stage in his journey. Every moment he turned good-humoredly on the throng around him, and gave some dashing sort of reply to their incessant queries, which appeared to convulse them with uncontrollable mirth. Struck by his demeanor, and the peculiarity of his appearance, so unlike that of the shaven-crowned and face-tattooed natives in general, I involuntarily rose as he entered the house, and proffered him a seat on the mats beside me. But without deigning to notice the civility, or even the more incontrovertible fact of my existence, the stranger passed on, utterly regardless of me, and flung himself upon the further end of the long couch that traversed the sole apartment of Marheyo's habitation. Had the belle of the season, in the pride of her beauty and power, been cut in a place of public resort by some supercilious exquisite, she could not have felt greater indignation than I did at this unexpected slight. I was thrown into utter astonishment. The conduct of the savages had prepared me to anticipate from every newcomer the same extravagant expressions of curiosity and regard. The singularity of his conduct, however, only roused my desire to discover who this remarkable personage might be, who now engrossed the attention of everyone. Tyner placed before him a calabash of poi-poi, from which the stranger regaled himself, alternating every mouthful with some rapid exclamation, which was eagerly caught up and echoed by the crowd that completely filled the house. When I observed the striking devotion of the natives to him, and their temporary withdrawal of all attention from myself, I felt not a little piqued. The glory of Tomo is departed, thought I, and the sooner he removes from the valley the better. These were my feelings at the moment, and they were prompted by that glorious principle inherent in all heroic natures, the strong-rooted determination to have the biggest share of the pudding, or to go without any of it. Marnu, that all-attractive personage, having satisfied his hunger and inhaled a few whiffs from a pipe which was handed to him, launched out into an harangue which completely enchained the attention of his auditors. Little as I understood of the language, yet from his animated gestures and the varying expression of his features reflected as Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.